Chapter 49. The Nasib border crossing marked the international border between Jordan and Syria. It sat right on the Amman-Damascus highway and had long been known as one of the busiest crossings for either country. But while the Jordanians had been able to keep their side under control, the Syrians hadn't been as successful. The Syrian side of the checkpoint had changed hands so many times throughout the civil war, there was no telling which interest might be in charge once you rolled up on it, or if it would technically even be open. But in Jordan, as in Syria and everywhere else, the right amount of money opened all doors. Williams had arranged for Harvath to ride up to Damascus with a Syrian truck driver. The agency had used him multiple times in the past. He's reliable. That was the best that Williams could say about him. Don't expect him to stick his neck out. Harvath didn't expect anything more than a ride. Williams pulled into a small roadside gas station and cafe a few kilometers from the border. He had one more thing to give Harvath. Reaching behind his seat, he retrieved a gray nylon camera bag and handed it to him. The camera is to further backstop your cover, but whatever pictures you can get, the agency would be glad to have.
Got it,
Harvath replied. There are two envelopes in the outer compartment. All the border guards know the going rate for safe passage. One envelope is for the Jordanian side, the other is for the Syrian.
And the rest of the money?
Inside the shoulder strap, said Williams. Harvath felt along the padding. They had done a good job layering the bills between the thin pieces of foam. You'll keep that in the cab of the truck, he continued, along with your backpack. The gun and everything else, though, is going in a hidden compartment in back. Harvath had figured as much. That said, he had already removed the knife and was going to keep it with him. If they caught him with it, then they caught him with it. Culturally, a knife for the Jordanians or the Syrians was not that big a deal. A gun or a taser, on the other hand, was a big deal. If you want to hit the head, Williams said as he put his car in park and turned off the ignition, now would be a good time. He nodded and followed him inside. As Williams went to locate his contact, Harvath used the restroom. Removing the camera from the bag, he checked to make sure the batteries were charged and a memory card was installed. Satisfied that everything was in order, he left the men's room, bought a bottle of water at the counter, and walked back outside to the parking lot. Williams was chatting with a heavy-set Syrian in a green sweat-stained t-shirt, gray polyester trousers, and tan sandals. When he saw Harvath, he waved him over.
Yusuf, this is Russ. Russ, this is Yusuf.
The men shook hands, and Williams spent several more moments speaking with Yusuf in Arabic. When he was done, Williams looked at Harvath and said,
Best of luck on your article. Don't forget to take lots of pictures.
I won't. What about the rest of my gear?
Already taken care of,
Williams replied. Then pulling Harvath in for a hug, he quietly said,
False compartment above last set of wheels, passenger side.
Got it,
said Harvath, as Williams backed away and waved him toward the cab.
Ready?
Yusuf asked. He had a mouthful of yellow teeth and wide eyes that showed the whites all the way around. He swept them back and forth, constantly assessing his surroundings.
Ready,
Harvath responded. They climbed into the cab of the truck. It was thick with the odor of cigarettes. The ashtray was crammed with butts. Several strings of beads hung from the rearview mirror. Harvath's backpack had already been placed behind his seat. He laid the gray camera bag at his feet. Yusuf started his vehicle and pulled out of the parking lot. Lighting a cigarette, he pointed out the window at the sky.
Good day for making a drive.
Harvath nodded.
Yes, good day. Where did you learn English?
University,
the man replied.
Aleppo.
What did you study?
With the cigarette hanging from between his lips, Yusuf changed lanes and said,
Transportation engineering. Now I drive truck.
Do you have a family?
He nodded.
It is why I drive this truck.
Someday the fighting will stop.
Inshallah.
Inshallah,
Harvath repeated.
Do you speak Arabic?
Kalilun. Only little.
Yusuf smiled and took a drag on his cigarette.
Why you want to go to Syria?
Harvath fished out his press credential from beneath his shirt and held it up.
Journalist.
They both knew that wasn't true.
Why Syria? He repeated. I'm looking for some people. Bad people?
Harvath nodded.
Syria has many of those,
Yusuf replied, removing the cigarette from his mouth and picking a piece of stray tobacco from his tongue.
What about you, Yusuf? Are you a bad man or a good man?
He thought about it for a moment and then, flashing his yellow smile, said,
It depends on the day.
Harvath liked him and smiled back.
How big is your family?
Yusuf's smile faded as he saw the Jordanian checkpoint up ahead.
We talk after we cross, he said.
Harvath nodded.
You have the money?
Harvath nodded again.
Give it to me.
Unzipping the side compartment of his camera bag, he removed the first envelope and handed it to him.
No talk,
Yusuf cautioned.
No Arabic. No insha'Allah.
Harvath understood. Better for him to play dumb. Let Yusuf do all the talking. This is what he was paid to do. Arriving at the checkpoint, they were surrounded by a team of four very serious-looking Jordanian soldiers. Yusuf cranked his yellow smile up to full wattage. They spoke for only a few moments, then Yusuf discreetly passed the envelope out the window. After looking inside the envelope, the lead soldier tucked it inside his tunic, smiled, and waved them through. Yusuf put the truck in gear and accelerated forward. As they rolled past the last of the troops and military barricades, Harvath looked in his side mirror.
That was easy, he remarked.
Yusuf crushed his cigarette out in the ashtray and quickly lit another one.
Jordan is always easy, he said. Now comes the hard part. Now comes Syria.
Chapter 50. Wide green fields, interspersed with razor wire and long walls of concrete block, created a no-man's land separating Jordan from Syria. Through the windshield, Harvath could see their next checkpoint up ahead.
Money, please,
Yusuf said, extending his hand. Harvath removed the final envelope and handed it to him.
Thank you. No talking, okay?
Harvath nodded as they neared the checkpoint, and Yusuf began to slow down. Things looked a lot different here than they had on the Jordanian side. Every single structure bore battle scars. All the buildings were pockmarked with bullet holes. Many had been charred by fire or explosions. They were unquestionably entering a war zone. Eight armed men swarmed the truck as they rolled to a stop under a large concrete awning. Yusuf cranked the smile back up. The men were unshaven, their fatigues dirty and wrinkled. They clutched their Kalashnikovs in their hands, fingers on the triggers. They were sloppy, undisciplined. It was a powder keg just waiting for a spark. A very bad feeling began to grow in Harvath's gut. His Arabic was good, but not good enough to keep up with the rapid-fire dialogue being shot back and forth. Things were definitely not going as well as they had on the other side. Finally, Yusuf nodded and put his truck in gear. Harvath had not seen any money change hands.
What's going on?
He asked.
They want me to pull ahead so they can search the truck.
Damn it, thought Harvath. He had known this was a possibility, but he had hoped it wouldn't happen. As they pulled over to the side, men surrounded the truck. Yusuf was told to shut the engine down and get out. Harvath's door was yanked open, and he was ordered out too. A man with horrible breath stood inches away from Harvath, demanding his passport. Harvath held up the laminated press credential hanging around his neck. The man slapped it away and repeated in heavily accented English,
Passport! Passport!
Slowly, Harvath removed his Canadian passport. The man snatched it from him and took a step back. He looked back and forth from Harvath to the picture several times. One of his buddies walked over and joined him. The man seemed to be preoccupied with something. He directed his colleague's attention to the photo and then over at Harvath. He then tugged on his own hair.
Fuck, Harvath thought. Not good.
The guy didn't like how recent his photo was.
Journalist,
Harvath stated, trying to take control of the situation.
Photo?
He asked, pantomiming the use of a camera. Turning, he reached back toward the truck for his camera bag. The men did not like his sudden move.
Oh, 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 oh,
they began yelling in unison, bringing their weapons to bear on him. Harvath raised his hands, palms out.
No photo? That's cool. No problem. Journalist,
he repeated, pointing at himself and then the laminated card around his neck.
Journalist.
Whoever these men were, they were very badly trained. Reaching for his camera bag had been a smart move. It had drawn them in closer. Two of them were so close that he could have disarmed either and shot the rest before any of them had any idea what was happening. Looking to his left, he saw Yusuf had isolated a commander. They were off to the side discussing something, probably money. Everyone in the Middle East assumed Westerners were rich, and by their standards, most were, which made them a prime target for extortion and kidnapping. If for some reason the cash in the second envelope turned out not to be enough, Harvath had extra in the camera bag shoulder strap, but that was supposed to see him through the rest of his operation. If he showed up in Damascus without any cash, he was going to run into serious trouble. Harvath watched their body language. Yusuf's conversation with the commander didn't appear to be going well. As the commander turned and began to walk away, Yusuf reached out and put his hand on the man's arm. No sooner had he done so than the commander spun and struck him. The blow hit so hard that it knocked him out. Yusuf fell to the ground and his head slammed against the pavement. Harvath moved to help him, but two of the men grabbed him by his arms and held him in place. The situation had just gone from bad to worse. Then the commander came over to deal with him. Harvath could tell that he was the alpha of this pack of wolves. He had cold, dark eyes. His brown, leathery face was crisscrossed with so many scars, it looked like a road map. He sported a thick mustache so black that it had to have been dyed. The armed man holding Harvath's Canadian passport handed it over to the commander. He commented in Arabic about Harvath's appearance in the photo. The commander studied both him and his passport. He then scrutinized his press credential. While he was doing so, Harvath's mind was working overtime. He had kept the Winkler knife with him. It was tucked in his waistband at the small of his back. The men holding him had no clue what they were doing. He could easily break their hold. At that point, he could grab the commander, put the knife up against his throat, and it would be an entirely new ball game. But the chances of an overzealous, undisciplined recruit deciding he might try to take a shot anyway was pretty high. What Harvath wouldn't have given at that moment for a sniper covering him over on the Jordanian side. The commander looked up from the passport and locked eyes with Harvath. It was obvious that there was something about him he didn't like. The feeling was definitely mutual. Lowering his eyes, Harvath glanced over at Yusuf. He was still flat on the ground, out cold. He wanted to knock this commander's block off. When Harvath returned his gaze, the man held it for several seconds and then, without breaking eye contact, ordered his men in Arabic to open the trailer. They all dispersed, except for the two holding on to Harvath. Throwing the trailer doors open wide, several of the men climbed inside. When one of the men popped his head out to report what they had found, the commander yelled for them to empty it out. Instead of traveling back with an empty truck, Yusuf had bought goods with his own funds. He had hoped to sell them in Damascus for a profit. There were cases of water, bags of flour and rice, batteries, toilet paper, soap and shampoo. Luxuries that citizens in the war-torn country would have paid handsomely for. Now, he was getting cleaned out. Yusuf had expected to lose some of the goods on the way back. It was the cost of doing business. Everyone took a cut. He hadn't, though, expected to lose everything. As the men unloaded the trailer, Harvath's blood pressure continued to rise. Poking out of the commander's tunic was the corner of the white envelope Yusuf had handed him. The man had accepted it, but he still wanted more.
The greedy son of a bitch.
Harvath was pissed. He wanted to reach out and snap the commander's neck. He hated men like this, men who preyed upon the weak. There was nothing, though, that Harvath could do about it. He had to suck it up and take it. All of it. With the trailer emptied out, the commander told his men to search the cab. The vultures weren't done yet. But just as the men were climbing into the vehicle, two new trucks approached from the other direction. The men paused and looked at their commander. He glanced at the incoming trucks. They were rolling heavy, which meant they had a buyer on the Jordanian side. They'd be carrying cash in order to be allowed to pass. It was shaping up to be a good day. He handed Harvath his passport back, but held onto it for a fraction of a second longer than he should have, as he fixed him with his icy stare. Finally, he released the document and nodded for his men to turn Harvath loose. They turned and headed to the other side of the checkpoint to fleece their next victims. Replacing the passport in his pocket, Harvath moved quickly to Yusuf, who had slowly regained consciousness.
"Are you okay?"
he asked, helping him to his feet. The Syrian nodded, but he was unsteady and needed to lean against him. Harvath helped him back to the cab and loaded him into the passenger seat.
"What are you doing?"
he asked.
"Don't worry. You need to rest."
"Can you drive?"
"Insha'Allah,"
Harvath replied, closing his door. Chapter 51. It was a rugged, desolate landscape. The brown, rocky soil was punctuated by thin, sickly trees. The only other life was an occasional goat tied up outside a crumbling mud-brick dwelling. The pitted four-lane highway they were on had seen better days. When Harvath felt he had put enough distance between them and the checkpoint, he pulled the truck over to the side of the road.
"What are you doing?"
Yusuf asked.
"I want to check you over. Make sure you're okay."
"I am okay."
"All the same."
"No,"
the Syrian insisted, opening his door and climbing down. Harvath opened his door and followed. Yusuf walked to the back of the trailer and opened the doors. He knew they had taken it all, but he needed to see for himself. He stood there for a long time, staring at the emptiness. A heavy black bruise had begun to grow beneath his right eye. Harvath stood next to him, but didn't speak.
"I have nothing now," he uttered.
"You'll make the money back."
The man shook his head.
"This was my last chance."
"What do you mean, your last chance?"
"I have no more money. I used everything we had to buy products in Jordan. Now, those are gone."
"You'll figure something out."
"I don't think so,"
Yusuf replied.
"I owe too many people too much money."
Removing a pack of cigarettes, he lit another and looked out across the fields.
"Syria,"
he said, shaking his head. Harvath felt terrible for the guy, but there wasn't anything he could do. He let him have a couple of more moments of quiet and then helped him close up the trailer.
"I think I will drive,"
Yusuf said.
"You sure you're okay?"
Harvath asked. He attempted a smile.
"Insha'Allah."
Before they got back in the cab, Harvath had him open up the hidden compartment where his pistol and other items had been hidden. Once he had transferred everything to his backpack, they climbed back in and got back on the road. Yusuf didn't feel much like talking. Harvath didn't blame him. He was content to ride in silence. The silence didn't last long. 10 minutes later, Yusuf changed his mind.
"Before the border, you asked about my family."
Harvath, who had been looking out the window, turned and faced him.
"I have a wife," said Yusuf, "one son, and two daughters."
Flipping his visor down, he removed a photo from inside the fabric and handed it to him. Harvath looked at Yusuf's family. They were on the chunky side, just like him, and had big, bright smiles. It was taken somewhere near the ocean. They looked happy.
"They're beautiful," Harvath said. "How old are your children?"
"The boy is 9,
and the girls are 11 and 13.
Harvath handed the photo back to him.
I'm sure you're very proud of them.
Yusuf looked down at the photo and smiled for a moment. But as soon as his smile appeared, it disappeared. He was obviously still very upset about having been robbed.
You'll figure something out, Harvath assured him. Don't give up.
He shook his head.
You don't understand. Understand what?
Never mind. Tell me about Ottawa.
Harvath laughed good-naturedly.
It's the capital of Canada? Now, let's talk about your situation.
Yusuf shook another cigarette free from his pack, placed it in his mouth, and reached for his lighter.
The money I lost today, I really needed it.
That's the great thing about money. You can always find a way to make more.
The Syrian took a deep drag on his cigarette, holding the smoke in his lungs for a long time before exhaling it toward his partially lowered window.
I have lung cancer.
Harvath felt horrible for the guy. Life in Syria was tough enough without cancer.
I'm sorry to hear that, Yusuf. What's your prognosis?
Without treatment, it's anybody's guess. 6 months, maybe.
That's what the money was for?
He nodded and took another deep drag.
You know, maybe you want to lay off the cigarettes.
Yusuf expelled another cloud of smoke through the window.
At this point, what difference does it make?
The man was probably right, but still.
Tell me about your wife. What does she do?
His face momentarily lifted into a smile.
She used to have a dress shop.
And now?
The dress shop is gone, like everything else in Aleppo. I moved my family to Damascus to find work. My wife is still looking.
Harvath wasn't a soft touch, but this guy was breaking his heart. Though he made his living pulling a trigger, he hated war. He absolutely hated it. For the last 20 minutes of their trip, Yusuf turned the conversation back to Ottawa. Harvath only knew a little about the city, so the rest he simply made up. He didn't like lying to the guy, but Yusuf wouldn't know. As they got closer to Damascus, everything became greener and more prosperous. This was, without a doubt, the seat of Syria's power, or, more appropriately, the seat of non-ISIS power. Passing a rather nice new building that looked like a school of some sort, Yusuf derisively snorted,
Iranians. They own that school?
Madrasa,
Yusuf corrected him.
They have built them all over Damascus.
What for? Said Harvath. You have that many Iranians?
Yusuf shook his head as he slowed for a stoplight.
The Iranians came to help prop up the regime. They want to convert everyone to Shia Islam. They set up madrasas and mosques, buy real estate, and import other Shia to live here. I think that's why the Syrian government invited the Russians in. They don't care about religion. They only care about power.
The man had no idea how right he was. As they rolled into the city, the landscaping grew even more dramatic. Full, healthy trees were everywhere. Grass lined the medians. Palm trees lined the sidewalks. Flowers spilled from planters. There were large apartment buildings, cafes, boutiques, and taxicabs. There were cars everywhere, as well as people walking and riding bikes. It reminded Harvath a bit of Washington, D.C. No matter how bad things were in the rest of the country, it managed to carry on as if nothing was wrong. It was astounding. He knew, though, that rebel-controlled neighborhoods outside the city, like Douma in the northeast, looked completely different. They were frequently targeted for shelling by the regime and resembled parts of Berlin after World War II.
You didn't expect this, said Yusuf,
as he watched Harvath taking it all in.
No. Have you been to Damascus before?
He shook his head.
I've been to other parts of Syria, but not Damascus.
Looking for bad people?
Yes, said Harvath.
Yusuf made another turn.
We're getting close. Where do you want me to drop you?
Williams had given Harvath a prepaid Syrian cell phone. Powering it up, he texted the number he had been given.
Stop up there, Harvath said.
indicating an area big enough to accommodate the truck. While Harvath waited for a response, Yusuf pulled off the street and parked. A few seconds later, Harvath's phone chirped. After reading the text, he asked Yusuf, "Where are we?" The Syrian told him, and Harvath typed a reply into his phone.
"Do you have another trip planned yet?" Harvath asked.
"Why? Will you need another ride?"
"Maybe. Do you have access to any other kinds of vehicles?"
"Yes,"
said Yusuf.
"But this is supposed to be my last journey for a while."
"Because of your treatment?"
The man nodded.
"How can I reach you if I need to?"
Yusuf gave him his cell phone number.
"Thank you," Harvath replied,
as he reached behind his seat and grabbed his backpack.
"Are you sure you want to get out here? It's not a very good neighborhood."
Harvath smiled at him.
"I'll be okay. I know what I'm doing. I'm a journalist."
The Syrian laughed.
"You're a good man," Harvath said, extending his hand.
"It depends on the day,"
Yusuf replied, extending his. Harvath gathered up his backpack and camera bag. Opening his door, he climbed down. He slung his pack, reached up for the door, and smiled once more at Yusuf.
"Keep your phone turned on," he said.
Then, shutting the door, he turned and disappeared into the crowded neighborhood. Chapter 52, Washington, D.C. Senator Wells stepped back into the Meet the Press green room from hair and makeup and helped himself to a Diet Coke. He knew most of the other guests and chatted with them briefly about what they would all be speaking on. Last week, the Sunday shows had been consumed with the attack on American personnel in Anbar and the horrific video depicting the rape of female embassy staffers. This week, it was all about the assassination of Secretary of Defense Devin and the suicide bombing at the White House. Out of the corner of his eye, Wells noticed his chief of staff engaged in a private conversation with one of the show's new producers. He had transferred in from NBC News in New York. Rebecca was wasting no time in getting to know him. Wells could feel the heat between the two of them all the way across the room. The woman was a force of nature and could have any man eating out of the palm of her hand within seconds. A young production assistant interrupted his thoughts. She came in and gave the 5-minute warning, and then turned up the sound on the monitors so that everyone could follow along with the program.
"You look terrific," Rebecca said,
as the producer left and she rejoined the senator.
"Very presidential."
"Make a new friend?"
"He's married, so we'll see," she said with a coy smile.
Wells put his hands up. "I don't want to know."
"Sure you don't," she whispered, as she leaned in and brushed some lint off his suit.
Even in a room full of people, she was incorrigible.
"They're going to lead with you. You'll be first up in the A block. They want to talk, obviously, about Secretary Devin and what happened at the White House. They also want to discuss what happened in Anbar and the story in the Washington Post this morning about President Porter possibly running his own black ops out of the Oval Office."
Liliana Grace had tipped him late last night that the story was going to run today. Under the headline, "America Under Attack," the Post was doing in-depth stories on the assassination of Devin and the suicide bomber at the White House. There was a follow-up on the Anbar attack, and tying it all together was Grace's story about the president's alleged program. The reporter had spent the last couple of days methodically tracking down every lead she could. She spoke to members of the Gang of Eight, the extra-tight circle of congresspeople and Intel committee members the president was required to brief. All confirmed that they had been briefed on Anbar. Off the record, Grace was able to confirm enough of what Wells had told her to pull together quite an impactful story. In quick succession, she explained the importance of the National Security Act of 1947, the Hughes-Ryan Amendment of 1974, the Intelligence Oversight Act of 1980, and the Intelligence Authorization Act of 1991, and their impact on the interlocking webs of Congress, the Oval Office, and the intelligence community. Instead of being dry policy speak or legalese, She made it sexy and intriguing, like something out of a dramatic high-stakes spy movie. She was a gifted reporter. This was going to be a great interview.
You've been on with Alan Gottlieb plenty of times, Rebecca reminded him. He's a great host, but he's not your friend, okay?
I've been doing this since before you were born. I know how to handle the press. Rebecca was about to respond when a middle-aged man wearing a headset and a Star Wars t-shirt entered the green room.
Senator Wells?
He asked.
Right here, Rebecca replied, waving him over.
Hello, Senator. I'm Abe from Audio. Just going to get you mic'd up here if I can.
Sure thing, Abe from Audio. Whatever you need, Wells answered. As soon as the technician had the microphone attached to the senator's lapel and the transmitter clipped to his waistband, he asked him to count to 10. Wells did as instructed, and Abe flashed him the thumbs up. Any IFB? The senator asked, pointing to his ear. Abe double-checked with the control room over his headset.
No, sir. They're not running any packages you need to listen to. You'll be speaking directly to Alan on the set.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Break a leg, Rebecca said, as Abe led the senator out of the green room and down the hall to the studio.
Out on the brightly lit set, Alan Gottlieb, a charming veteran journalist with a $100 haircut and a $1,500 suit, was running through his opening monologue. Abe from Audio showed the senator to his seat. A PA brought over a mug featuring the show's logo and filled with water and placed it in front of him. As soon as Gottlieb had finished his monologue, he reached over and shook hands with Wells.
Good to see you again, Senator. Thank you for joining us this morning.
30 seconds, the floor director said. The crew took their places. Cameras were adjusted one final time, and the next thing they knew, they were live. As Gottlieb read his monologue from the teleprompter, Wells watched the video montage that the viewers at home were seeing. It was a mashup of news footage, combined with the propaganda videos ISIS published after the attack in Anbar and on Secretary Devin in Turkey. Rounding it all out, was footage of what had happened at the White House. The red light above Camera 1 came on, and Gottlieb welcomed viewers to the program. After introducing Senator Wells, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, they were off and running. The senator struck the proper tone right out of the gate. He expressed sadness over those who had died, extended condolences to their friends and loved ones, and promised that the victims would not be allowed to have died in vain. He could have been delivering an address right from the Oval Office itself. It was that perfect. Even though he had not been at all close with Secretary Devin, he played up his respect for the man and the friendship they'd shared. Rebecca had briefed him on the names of Devin's wife and children, and he rattled them off as if they had spent every weekend together. Wells was nothing if not a master manipulator, a thoroughly professional politician. Back in the green room, Rebecca wasn't watching the monitors. She was watching the guests as they watched the monitors. All of them were riveted, hanging on the senator's every word. Rebecca smiled.
Jesus, he's good, she said to herself.
They were going to go all the way to the White House together. She just knew it. As the interview wound down, Gottlieb had one last question.
Finally, Senator. I want to ask you to comment on something.
Go ahead, Alan, Wells replied.
We understand that your committee may have information that the White House knew of a possible threat in advance of Secretary Devin's trip to Turkey. A, is this true? And B, what specifically did the White House know? And not only when did they know it, but what did they do about it?
The producer bit. Rebecca had felt sure he would. The moment he had heard that a competing network was after the story, he had been hooked. They didn't like to air their gossip or speculation, but this was too big a scoop to risk not being first on. His only concern had been how to properly phrase the question, so there was no blowback for Gottlieb and their team. On set, the senator's jaw tensed. He wanted to ask Gottlieb where he had heard that, but he knew damn well. Rebecca had told somebody.
Damn it.
They were going to have a very long talk when they left the studio. Without missing a beat, Wells replied, ISIS has made it very clear that they consider all Americans potential targets. Anytime the president, a cabinet member, a member of Congress, travels overseas, there's increased risk. But are you aware, sir, of any specific threat that existed against Secretary Devin on his trip to Antalya, Turkey? Gottlieb had him between a rock and a hard place. If he said yes, and Rebecca's information, which he still had not substantiated, turned out to be false, he'd be in trouble. If he said no, and Rebecca's information turned out to be true, he'd look like he didn't have his finger on the pulse of what was going on. The national security cornerstone of his campaign was going to be built upon his experience as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. So, he gave the only answer he could give. Alan, unfortunately, I am not at liberty to discuss what the committee may or may not be working on. In light of everything that's happened over the last week and a half, I'm sure you can understand. Of course, Senator, the host replied. Thank you for being with us today. After teasing the next segment, they went to a commercial, and the floor director gave the all clear. Wells took off his microphone and immediately went looking for his chief of staff. At CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, Brendan Kavanaugh had had the television in his office on in the background. He didn't need to rewind and play back what he had heard. He knew exactly what Senator Wells had said. He grabbed for his cell phone, pulled up his recent call list, and hit redial.
We're just getting ready to leave the studio. Can I call you back?
No, said Kavanaugh.
We need to talk right now.
Chapter 53 Damascus, Syria. In better times, twin brothers Toman and Metan Hadid could have passed for DJs or owners of a trendy local night spot. The handsome young men were in their late 20s. They had olive skin and brown eyes. They wore their dark hair long enough to be swept back behind their ears. Their father was a politician who had been brutally tortured and executed by the Syrian regime. His sons had been working for the opposition ever since. Though they were young, McGee had assured Harvath that the Hadid brothers were two of the CIA's best assets in the entire country. Before the war, they had been college students. Now Toman drove a cab and Metan ran a small mechanic shop. Harvath found Toman's taxicab idling three blocks from where Yusuf had dropped him. Sliding in back, he said,
I'd like to visit the Umayyad Mosque.
At this time of day, the young man replied, it is better to visit the Chapel of St. Paul.
What about the Midhat Pasha Souk?
It is always a good time to visit the Souk.
With their authentication complete, Harvath leaned back in his seat and Toman activated his meter and pulled out into traffic. The young man took a long and circuitous route. Harvath watched as they passed through neighborhood after neighborhood, occasionally glancing down at the GPS on his phone to see where they were. 11 minutes into their ride, he made Toman come to a stop and take a right turn. As he did, a white motorcycle zoomed past.
He's been following us for the last 6 blocks, Harvath said.
I know,
the young Syrian replied. They drove for another 15 minutes. The streets were full of traffic. Buses, cars, trucks, taxis. Everyone was honking. They honked to change lanes, to signal where they were, and to allow others to pass. It reminded Harvath of Cairo, where they did exactly the same thing. There were people everywhere. Many of them were smokers. Both men and women appeared partial to Western fashion. A majority of women, but not all, chose to cover their hair with the Islamic headscarf known as the hijab. Some also covered their faces. Many of the buildings they passed were run down, and some looked downright abandoned. One dramatic high-rise looked as if it had been sitting unfinished for decades. Damascus was not a booming city. It was bleeding out, dying. They parked the taxi in a quiet neighborhood, and Harvath and Toman proceeded on foot. The young Syrian was wearing canvas high tops, black jeans, and a leather jacket.
Underneath, he sported a t-shirt emblazoned with the face of American comedian Bill Murray wearing a pair of 3D glasses. They walked silently down a narrow alleyway to a set of tall wooden doors. At some point, they had been painted blue, but all the paint had long since chipped off and faded away. Toman removed an old-fashioned skeleton key and opened the doors. It smelled like overripe garbage and cardboard boxes. Leaning against the wall was the white motorcycle Harvath had seen earlier. There was a small, wrought-iron staircase, illuminated by a cracked skylight several stories up. Toman motioned for Harvath to follow him. They climbed to the third floor, where he knocked against a heavy metal door. A shadow appeared at the peephole. Bolts were then pulled back, and the door opened. Maitan greeted them dressed in blue jeans, boots, and a t-shirt, proclaiming, "Keep calm and chive on." Tucked in his waistband was a 9mm Browning high-power pistol. He stood back so they could pass, and then closed and locked the door behind them. Toman made the introductions. In addition to Arabic, both of the brothers spoke English and French. "Hungry?" Maitan asked as he led the men into the apartment. It was long and narrow, with exposed brick walls and timber beams. There were no bedrooms, only a large living space. The kitchen was comprised of a deep utility sink, a small fridge, a microwave, and a camping stove attached to a tank of propane. Non-perishable food and other necessities like candles, batteries, and toilet paper were organized on commercial metal shelving. Cases of bottled water were stacked on the floor.
"Yes, thank you," Harvath replied.
He hadn't eaten since before leaving Amman. There was an old wooden table with mismatched plastic chairs. Toman pulled one out and invited Harvath to sit. Maitan went to work pulling a few things from the fridge and nuking them in the microwave. In short order, he set down a stack of warm pita bread, stuffed grape leaves, and a dish of lamb meatballs in tomato sauce. They were very fortunate not to be in one of the rebel areas blockaded by the regime. Toman offered Harvath a bottle of room-temperature water, which he gladly accepted. After Maitan set the last item down and joined them at the table, he gestured for Harvath to begin serving himself. As they ate, the Hadids peppered him with questions about the conditions he had seen on his drive-in. Harvath recounted all of it, including the trouble on the Syrian side of the border. When Harvath was done with his recap, he asked the brothers about the strength of the opposition and how their fight was going.
"Russia's escalations have changed everything," said Maitan as he brewed tea. "They're here for one reason, and one reason only, to protect the regime and their own interests. They do not care about anything else. Nothing."
"They're also incredibly brutal," Toman added. 25 regime soldiers could be killed in an attack, and they would do nothing. But if a Russian was so much as scratched by a piece of glass, they go and unleash hell."
Harvath nodded.
"That's the Russian way. They never forget, and they never forgive. You know the old joke, right?"
The brothers looked at him.
"What joke?" Maitan asked.
"An angel appears to three men, a Frenchman, an Italian, and a Russian," said Harvath, "and tells them that tomorrow the world is going to end. The angel asks what they want to do during their last night on Earth. The Frenchman says he will get a case of the best champagne and spend his last night with his mistress. The Italian says he will visit his mistress and then go home to a last meal with his wife and children. And the Russian?" Harvath asks, cocking his eyebrow and adopting a thick Russian accent. "Burn my neighbor's barn."
The Hadids laughed. It was a good joke, and encapsulated who and what the Russians were.
"So," said Toman, "you're here to help create hell for the Russians."
"And hopefully ISIS, too," Harvath replied.
"How?"
He held up his hand.
"First things first. Let's talk about the person we asked your people to put under surveillance."
The Hadids took Harvath through everything they had learned about the subject. They showed him a map of the man's neighborhood, the photographs their people had taken, and their list of what they saw as their best options.
Harvath sat quietly and took it all in. They were about to mount a very serious operation. Nothing could be taken for granted. Every step they took had to be perfect. When the brothers finished debriefing Harvath, he had only one question for them.
How soon can we move?
Chapter 54. Despite his pride in the armed forces of the Russian Federation, Lieutenant General Oleg Proskurov didn't wear a uniform. Neither did the four-man Spetsnaz team assigned to protect him. They rolled in civilian clothes and armored civilian vehicles. The idea was for them to fit in, but in Syria, the gaggle of Russians stuck out like a sore thumb. The one thing that didn't stick out, though, was a building they had codenamed the Salt Box. During his interrogation in Malta, Viktor Sergun had given up both its purpose and location. It was part safe house, part interrogation facility. Proskurov had chosen it because it was close enough to the Russian embassy to be easily accessed, but in a part of town known to be hostile to the Iranians. Tehran was notorious for the volume of spying it conducted. The less chance the Iranians had of stumbling onto or surveilling the salt box, the better. It was a spoke in the wheel of a larger GRU operation. Proskurov had been tasked with eliminating ISIS. Using Sasha Basayev to infiltrate their ranks had been his idea. The operation, thus far, had gone better than he had planned. Basayev was an incredibly gifted operator, which made the email he had received from Colonel Sergun very disturbing. Sergun was suddenly having doubts about Basayev. Using a false American passport that had been left for him in Washington, Basayev had flown to Rome. From there, he had flown to Athens and on to Cyprus. From Cyprus, a plane was waiting to fly him to Syria. ISIS was anxious to congratulate him and celebrate his attacks on the United States. As long as Basayev was going to be back in Syria, Proskurov thought it a good idea that they sit down and have a talk. He wanted to measure for himself whether or not Basayev's loyalty was slipping, and so he had sent an encrypted email to Sergun in return, ordering him to set it up. What Proskurov didn't know was that he hadn't been communicating with Sergun in Berlin, but rather with a little person in Northern Virginia named Nicholas. For his part, Nicholas was on very thin ice. Getting into Sergun's email account wasn't a problem, nor was communicating in Russian, as it was his mother tongue. The problem was selecting the right words. That's where Vela had come in. Vela worked very carefully to draw all the correct information out of Sergun. This included identifying any codes he would be expected to use to indicate whether or not he was under duress. Everything appeared to have gone off without a hitch. Proskurov had requested a rendezvous with Basayev for Sunday night and had set the salt box as the location. After that, it was all up to Harvath. The first and biggest problem for Harvath was Proskurov's security detail. The only advantage he had on his side was surprise. The Spetsnaz operatives were elite, far better trained than anyone Toman or Maitan Hadid could bring to the fight. They were going to get one shot at taking Proskurov. That one shot had to be so overwhelming that his detail had absolutely no hope of surviving. The problem, though, was how to take out Proskurov's men without taking out Proskurov himself. For what Harvath had planned, he needed Proskurov, at least for a little while longer. The other issue they faced was equipment. The CIA had only made certain weaponry available to the rebels. The things Harvath really wanted were impossible to get. And even if he could get them, he didn't have nearly enough money to pay for them. In the condition Syria was in, no one was taking IOUs, especially not for the kind of sophisticated shopping list Harvath had envisioned. He would have to make do with what the Hadids had been able to rustle up. In addition to enough radios and AK-47s to outfit the entire team, they had one 12-gauge shotgun, one Iranian Sayad 250 caliber rifle with night vision optics, a few sets of individual thermal goggles,
a box of old Soviet F-1 hand grenades, and two Yugoslavian OSAS, or WASPs in English, anti-tank rockets with launchers. Harvath didn't like having to hang the success of his operation on hand grenades from the Soviet days or rockets from the former Yugoslavia, but it was all they had. Their only hope of taking Proskurov was when he was in transit, and when he was in transit, it was via armored land cruisers. Harvath's plan was going to have to work. Having seen Matan's helmet with its full face mask and shaded visor, he asked if he could borrow his motorcycle. He would only get one opportunity to drive by the salt box, and this seemed the best way to do it. Toman, in his cab, led the way through the crowded city streets. Harvath followed behind on the motorcycle. When they were two blocks away, Toman pulled over and rolled down his window. Harvath pulled up alongside him.
At the next intersection, make a left turn. The building is halfway down on your right. You can't miss it. I'll wait for you here.
Harvath drove up to the intersection and made a left turn. Keeping the motorcycle in low gear, he moved slowly up the street. He tried to take everything in. It would have been nice to have some sort of a low-profile video camera with him. The neighborhood was a mix of shops and residences. If they got into it out in the street, there was a good chance innocent people might get killed. It wasn't Harvath's first choice, but as he rolled forward, he was hard-pressed to see any other option. They had to take Proskurov, and they were going to have to take him in the street. But then, as he drew even with the salt box, he saw its pair of solid metal gates. This wasn't just a building. It was a compound. The curb was cut away, and there was a driveway of some sort. Courtyards were a common architectural feature throughout the Middle East. While they often had a fountain, Harvath was willing to bet that this courtyard was used for parking. It made sense. If you were smuggling people in or out, you wanted to hide as much of your activity as possible. And one of the last things you wanted to do, in a hostile nation like Syria, was to risk having your vehicle tampered with by leaving it unattended outside. If you could, securely storing it off the street was the best plan. The rent, even by Syrian standards, must have been very expensive for this property. There were some things, though, that even the notoriously cheap Russians were willing to spend money on. Harvath continued his slow tour past the salt box, and then around the block before circling back to Toman. The next thing he wanted to do was to get up onto one of the nearby rooftops. After finding a place to park, they identified a building six doors down from the salt box that appeared abandoned. With Toman standing guard, Harvath went to work on the lock. In less than a minute, he had it open and they slipped inside. The interior of the empty structure was coated in a heavy layer of dust. The unventilated air was stagnant. It was four flights of rickety wooden stairs to get to a narrow door that led out onto the roof. Here, he had an amazing view over the rooftops of Damascus. It was an ocean of satellite dishes, hot water tanks, and solar panels as far as the eye could see. The buildings leaned right against each other, so he and Toman were able to move from rooftop to rooftop until they got close enough to have a perfect view of the two-story salt box. Peering down, the first thing Harvath noticed was that he had been correct. There was a paved courtyard right in the center, and it was just big enough to hold two, maybe three SUVs, but no more. He noticed something else. There was no back door, at least not for the vehicles. They would have to go out through the gates, the same way they came in. People, though, were a different story. No safe house had only one way in or out. There was always an additional exit, sometimes more. It could be through a neighboring property on either side, through the building that abutted the salt box in back. It could be through a tunnel or a sewer system underground that people weren't aware of. It could also be via the rooftops where Harvath was right now. It could be any combination thereof. There was no way to be absolutely certain. They would have to cover all their bases. The effective range of their shoulder-fired missiles was 350 meters. Harvath turned in a slow circle, looking at the other buildings around them.
Once he spotted the perfect position, he pointed at it and said,
"That's where we're going to put the wasps. The shooters will have a perfect view of the courtyard from there, and should be able to take out both of Proskurov's armored SUVs."
Toman looked at the building he was pointing at and then back at Harvath.
"There's just one problem."
"What's that?"
"None of my people have ever fired a wasp before."
Chapter 55. While the operation of the wasp wasn't exactly idiot-proof, it had been designed to be as close to it as possible. It made no difference how powerful a weapon was if the operator couldn't hit his target. Under the stress of combat, there was a lot that could go wrong. Everything came down to training. Two of the Hadid's men had extensive experience firing RPGs. Those were the men Harvath chose for the wasps. Normally, a wasp team was made up of two people, one to load and one to fire. They couldn't afford to sacrifice that much manpower. In addition to the two men who would be firing the wasps, the Hadid's best sniper would be their loader. After the missiles had been fired, he would take up position behind the single-shot 50-caliber rifle. One of the wasp operators would pick up a pair of binoculars and act as his spotter. The remaining wasp operator would leave the overwatch position and close on the salt box, staying back just far enough so that he could ambush any reinforcements that might arrive faster than anticipated. Harvath was a big believer in the old saying that anything that could go wrong would go wrong, so plan for it. Proskurov and his security detail wouldn't be calling the Syrians for help. They'd be calling their own people back at the Russian embassy. That didn't mean, though, that the Damascus police and the Syrian military weren't going to come running as soon as explosions and gunshots were reported. It was going to be like kicking a hornet's nest. Now, fully assembled in the abandoned building, Harvath went over the plan while Maitan translated into Arabic. Each man was given a printout of Proskurov's picture.
"This is our target," Harvath said. "He is no good to us dead. Rule number one, do not shoot him. Is that clear?"
All of the men nodded. Harvath looked at Maitan and said,
"Make each one of them say it out loud."
Maitan did as Harvath instructed. He made each of the eight men they had assembled, plus his brother, pledge not to injure Proskurov.
"Rule number two," Harvath continued, as Maitan translated, "do not shoot me."
The men chuckled, but stopped as soon as they saw how serious he was. He didn't care how long they had been fighting and what kind of combat they had seen. They were not professionals. He hadn't come this far to be killed by friendly fire. Harvath looked at Maitan, who then looked at each of the men and had them repeat rule number two. When that was done, he dove into the meat of his plan. The salt box had a rooftop entry, similar to the building they were in now. Harvath expected the door to be bolted shut. Back at the Hadid's, he had shown the brothers how to superheat candle wax, stir in buckshot, and reload several of their shotgun shells with the mixture to create breaching rounds. Done correctly, a door could be blown right out of its frame. The plan was for six men to enter via the rooftop stairwell. Harvath and the Hadid's would make up one team. Three more men, selected by Toman, would make up the other. Harvath and the Hadid's were the lead assault force. The second team had only one job, to hold the stairwell and make sure Harvath and the Hadid's didn't get flanked. The more Harvath thought about it, the more he believed the roof was Plan B for the Russians. If they couldn't get safely out by the front gates, that was how they'd make their escape. So as he and the Hadid's moved toward the ground floor, he expected them to be coming up, especially considering how they were going to kick everything off. The first thing they needed to do was deny them access to the armored vehicles. Those things were rolling safe rooms. They were extremely difficult to breach without harming the occupants. And knowing the Russians, their cars came equipped with some very nasty countermeasures. That was why Harvath had decided to destroy both vehicles with the wasps.
As soon as he had heard the detonations, they would come out from behind cover, hit the door, and make their way down into the salt box. On the very off chance that Proskurov's protective detail interpreted the destruction of their vehicles as the result of rebel mortar fire gone astray, Harvath had the Hadid's remaining two men posted outside. Once the fireworks started, they had been told to shoot any Russians they saw, except for Proskurov. With their SUVs destroyed and gunmen outside on the street, the Spetsnaz soldiers would hustle their protectee to the roof. They'd leave a couple of men to engage the shooters to help give the rest of the team a head start, but they would definitely be going to Plan B. There was just one last thing Harvath needed. Pushing his earpiece in a little further, he asked,
"Am I going to have what I need?"
"I think so," Nicholas replied from back in Northern Virginia.
"I think isn't good enough. I need you to be 100%.
"I'm at 99.9, the little man said. "Give me a few more seconds."
Even if Harvath was taking on just one Spetsnaz soldier, he'd still want every advantage he could muster. The only way he was going to win taking on four of them was to cheat. That was where Nicholas came in.
"We good?"
Harvath asked, prodding him.
"One more second."
Harvath could picture him in his skiff back in the United States, furiously moving his tiny fingers across his keyboard.
"Got it,"
Nicholas finally responded.
"Got it, you think? Or you're sure you've got it?"
"Dinner on me if I'm wrong."
"Easy bet for you," Harvath replied. "If you're wrong, I'm not going to be around to collect."
"Then for your sake, I'd better be right."
Harvath smiled and shook his head. Graveyard humor. The SEALs had been merciless with jokes. The more intense the situation, the more the jokes flew. It was the same thing with the Army and the Marines. Even cops, he knew. It was a coping mechanism, a relief valve. Staring the possibility of death in the eye created more than a little stress. Humor helped get operators through. With Nicholas online and all of the Hadid's men fully briefed, they went over everything once more. They were as ready as they were going to be. Looking at his watch, Harvath then turned to Toman and Maitan, and speaking in a heavy Russian accent said,
"Let's go burn neighbor's barn."
Chapter 56. General Oleg Proskurov was a careful man, a planner. He understood that even the smallest, most insignificant detail could throw off the greatest of undertakings. History was replete with brilliant men undone by seemingly minuscule factors. And so Sergin's concerns about Basayev troubled him. Basayev was too important to lose. Perhaps they were leaning on Basayev too heavily. Perhaps he was feeling the stress of being too long in the field. His operations tempo had been excruciating. He had been asked to pull off not one spectacular feat, but several. It would have taken its toll on anyone. Proskurov had been thinking about the right way to deal with him. If Basayev was beginning to crack, should they keep him in the game? Would a couple of days off help him catch his breath? Would he need more than that? A week? Could they even afford to take him out of play at this point? The Americans were on the edge of getting in. He knew it. He could feel it in his bones. It was only a matter of time. The attack on the White House was a national affront to their overinflated sense of honor. The U.S. could launch 1,000 cruise missiles, but it wouldn't assuage the anger and humiliation felt by its citizens. For the last 2 weeks, Proskurov had been watching American television news. He knew what Americans were thinking and feeling. Even the most dovish among them was admitting that ISIS had grown into too great a problem to be ignored. They were clamoring for ISIS to be dealt with once and for all. The American president, though, was weighing his options. Proskurov understood why. This was nothing to rush into. United States citizens would be baying for blood. They would demand a quick, decisive engagement. Shock, awe, and carnage. That's all.
No nation building. Come in, kill all the vipers in the pit, and go home. They had no stomach for an occupation. That was good. Russia didn't want an American occupation either. It needed an exterminator, not a roommate. As soon as ISIS was defeated by the Americans, Russia could fully crush the Syrian opposition. Then, with the Syrian regime back on its feet, Russia could extend its territorial ambitions in the region. As America receded, Russia would take center stage. General Proskurov was in his late 60s. Up until this point, he hadn't known if he would live to see such a thing in his lifetime. The idea of an ascendant Russia was beyond anyone's imagination just a few short years ago. Then came Ukraine, and now Syria. Instead of shrinking, Russian influence was growing. But Proskurov knew that as it grew, it was important to maintain stability at home. One of the greatest domestic threats Russia faced was from Islamic radicals. That was why it was so important to keep Sasha Basayev in the game. His penetration of ISIS and its inner core was a great accomplishment of the GRU, but his mission wasn't over yet. The GRU still needed him to secure the intelligence on all the Russian speakers who had come to train and fight with ISIS. Where had they come from? How many had returned home? How many had stayed behind? How many had been killed or wounded? How were they recruited? Who had done the recruiting? Were specific plans in the works for attacks inside Russia? What and who were their targets? How did cell members communicate? How were they financed? And so on. It was critical intelligence, and no one was better positioned than Basayev to secure it. Whatever Proskurov needed to say, whatever he needed to promise, he would. It was imperative that Basayev complete his assignment. The general looked out the thick bulletproof glass of his land cruiser as they drove through the streets of Damascus. It was an intriguing city, exotic but with enough modern conveniences to make it comfortable. He liked it better than Moscow. That wasn't saying much, though. He liked any place better than Moscow. The only place he disliked more was his hometown, Dzerzhinsk. It was a hub for Russia's chemicals industry, and with the chemical companies had come chemical weapons programs. Dzerzhinsk, appropriately enough, had been named after the very first head of Russia's secret police. Its soil and water were polluted. Birth defects and cancer were through the roof. It was said that the death rate in Dzerzhinsk was 3 times the birth rate. Only Chernobyl was more toxic. Proskurov shuddered at the thought of it. He was glad to have gotten out. But while he had turned his back on Dzerzhinsk, Dzerzhinsk hadn't turned its back on him. A year into his first marriage, he learned he was sterile. The doctors couldn't identify a cause. He, though, knew exactly what had robbed him of the ability to produce offspring. Dzerzhinsk. His hate for the city of his birth swelled. His wife ended up leaving him because of his sterility. It was a crushing blow. As only a true Russian can, he had drowned his pain in vodka and thrown himself into his military career. He remarried years later. She had no children and didn't want any. She was a good enough companion. She didn't mind his long stretches away from home. When he was home, she cooked for him and they made love. All told, it would have been cheaper to keep a one-room apartment and visit prostitutes in Moscow. But knowing he was tied to another human being somewhere in the world made his assignments abroad more bearable. It didn't, though, make any of them easier, especially not this one. Russia had gone all in on Syria, and after they had gone all in, they had doubled down. They didn't intend to allow the Turks, the Saudis, or anyone else to dislodge them. In addition to the recently arrived Slava-class guided missile cruiser Moskva and 3 more Rapuka-class amphibious assault ships based at Tartus, Russia's sole aircraft carrier, the Admiral Kuznetsov, was now in the Mediterranean along with her escort, the Admiral Chabanenko, and Udaloy II-class destroyer. Then there were the aircraft. 90 kilometers north of Tartus was the Hemaimin Air Base, accessible only to Russian personnel.
In the last 2 days, a fleet of Su-35S super-maneuverable multi-role fighters had been flown in. They were the most modern fighter aircraft in service with the Russian Air Force, and this was the first time they had ever been put into operation outside Russia's borders. Two Tu-214Rs had also been flown in. The Tu-214R was Russia's most advanced reconnaissance and surveillance aircraft. With all-weather radar systems and highly sophisticated electro-optical sensors, the spy plane was incredibly adept at pinpointing hidden or camouflage targets. It could also scoop up and monitor enemy communications and electronic signals. Topping it all off, state-of-the-art S-400 defense missile systems had been moved into Syria to protect Russian assets. The message Russia was sending to the rest of the world was crystal clear: don't fuck with us. It was an enormous gamble, which made Proskurov's task even more crucial. He would not be the man who let his country down. Rolling up to the salt box, one of the detail agents jumped out and opened up the gates. After the SUVs were through, he closed the gates behind them. Inside the courtyard, the vehicles turned around so that they were facing out, ready to leave once Proskurov's meeting was over. The Spetsnaz operative opened the general's door, and the man stepped out with his laptop bag over his shoulder and a small cardboard box, which contained tea and a few other items from back home he thought Basayev might enjoy. Removing a key ring from his pocket, he unlocked one of the courtyard doors and stepped inside. There was a samovar in the kitchen. He wanted to fire it up and start heating water for tea. He found making tea the old-fashioned way relaxing. It also tasted better than using an electric kettle. His favorite tea was Russian Caravan, a blend of oolong, kimen, and lapsang souchong. It had a smoky flavor to it that mimicked the tea of old, imported from China to Russia via camel caravans. During the long journey, sometimes a year to a year and a half, the tea absorbed its distinct flavor from the caravan campfires. Placing the samovar in the sink, he filled it with water. Then, removing the sack of kindling and wood chips he kept in the cabinet, he packed the cylinder in the center with just the right amount of fuel. Patting his pockets, he realized that he had left his cigarettes and with them his lighter in the car. There had to be a box of kitchen matches somewhere, though. After looking through several drawers, he finally found them in a cabinet near the coffee mugs. Placing the samovar on the stove, he removed a match from the box, but hesitated in striking it. The hair on the back of his neck was suddenly standing on end. He didn't know what, but something was wrong. Setting the match and matchbox down on the counter, he turned to walk out of the kitchen. As he did, an enormous explosion detonated outside, shattering the windows and sending an enormous shockwave through the building.